Ho ho ho. Okay, so we now have the questions. Aha. And this first anonymous question from... Hey? Dear Ajahn, I slept for some hours this afternoon. How do you know if this one is sleeping too much after the meal? Because if you sleep too much, it would mean that you get up and you're still groggy. If you sleep too little, you get up and you get groggy. There is just the middle way, just the right amount. And so sometimes, one of the nicest things to do is don't look at your clock. If you have a clock somewhere, hide it. And so just when you wake up, you wake up. It could be 1 o'clock in the morning, it could be 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So don't be a prisoner of time. Keep it natural. That's the very best. I'm having weird, bad dreams. Excellent. Because you should write them down. And that could be the script of a major best-selling book. And if it's really weird, that could also be the start of a franchise on movies. One of the dreams was about you. Uh-oh. You were dying during the retreat, which ended earlier, but there was a big party. I'm going to lock the door of my room tonight. I'm going to put a guard on the outside. Someone's got it in for me. In for me. They've got it in for me. So anyway... You were dying to envy. It's all symbolic. So now dreams don't mean what you think they mean. So it means you are dying, which means you die from the world. So there's no more greed, hatred and delusion. There's no more defilements. There's no more wanting. And so that's the cause of a great party. So that's what's happening. And you are projecting on me the fact you're going to die from the world, you're going to become fully enlightened, and that'll be the greatest party. Do you believe me? No, obviously not. Okay, weird and bad dreams, because sometimes we interpret the dreams. The dreams are just like the old blank canvas, and it's just how we interpret them. That's what's really important. Just like that fellow some years ago, who had a dream here in Perth. He dreamt of 5 angels. Someone already knows where this is going. And those 5 angels appeared to him in a dream. And each one of those angels had 5 pots of gold. And they lined up to give him 5 pots of gold each, worth an absolute fortune. And when he woke up, just as the last pot of gold was being handed to him, he opened his eyes. He was in his bedroom. He didn't see any angels. He didn't mind that, but there was no gold. It was just a dream, but one of those very vivid dreams which you can't forget. So he got up and made to get some breakfast, and it was really strange. That morning, his wife had made him 5 pieces of toast and 5 boiled eggs and 5 bananas as well. Might as well add a bit. Healthy food. And he was wondering, what is with this number 5? And when he looked at the newspaper, 5th of May, the 5th day of the 5th month, and he thought, is this some sort of omen? So he looked in the horse racing section. There is a horse racing course here in Perth named after the famous one in England called Ascot. A-S-C-O-T. 5 letters. So he looked in race number 5. Horse number 5. He couldn't believe what he saw. in race number five, horse number five, was called Five Angels. Wow. You only get this chance maybe once in your life, if at all. So he took the afternoon off work to keep the lucky number five. He drew $5,000 out of his bank account, cash. And he went to the horse racing course. He chose the fifth bookmaker in line to keep the lucky number five. $5,000 to win horse number five, race number five. Five Angels. He knew the lucky number five couldn't be wrong. The lucky number five wasn't wrong. His horse came in fifth. That is the trouble with dreams. But against that, that's just a funny story. Against that, this was a true story. There's, oh, I think some of you, I don't mind saying who it is. Remember, you know, Gus and Julie? Now, Julie was a Singaporean girl. Gus was, he was in the British Army. He was a dental technician. So they met in Singapore, fell in love, got married. And so, he's getting a bit old now. But he was, he used to every year have to go home, you know, to Singapore to meet his in-laws, Chinese New Year, that sort of stuff. And where do they live? Just in the West Coast. And I guess the Northwest. I forget now, anyway. But anyway, that... it's the tip of my tongue. But anyway, that he was getting really bored, you know, as they were yakking away. And so his brothers-in-law said to him, you know, do you want to go to the horse racing this afternoon? And he would never really be interested in the horse racing, but he was so bored, so might as well. So he went with his brothers, but before they went to the horse racing, it's in Badok, before they went to the horse racing, they had to go to the lucky temple, first of all. They had a lucky Buddhist temple. And just to offer some flowers and incense and that sort of stuff for good luck. But what happened there? When they went inside the temple, it was really dirty. So all of them, including Gus, they swept it and cleaned it up before they put some incense and asked for good luck. And this is what happens when you actually, you know, you clean things up. And so what happened was they went to the horse racing place that afternoon. You know what happened? They all lost. But that night, Gus, he had a dream of a horse race, which and the horse won. And so, in the morning, you remember the name of the horse, looked in the Straits Times newspaper, that horse, which he dreamt about the night before, was running that afternoon. And so he called up his in-laws, his brothers-in-law, say, hey, yeah, we lost yesterday, but last night I dreamt of a horse. I dreamt of it, and it's running this afternoon. Come on. Whoever the spirit of that temple is looking after us. And these Singaporean brothers-in-law say, listen, no self-respecting Singapore spirit will look after the foreigners. They look after us, first of all. So you're making it up. No. So he went alone. And you know, that won. It was a real premonition. He won a lot of money that afternoon. And when he told his brothers-in-law, then his brothers-in-law were mad enough about losing money the day before, but they were incensed that these Singapore spirits, they look after they call them Ang Mo, these foreigners, instead of looking after their own. And so they're really, really upset, but it was true. He won a lot of money. So because he cleaned up, you clean up the temple, and then you clean up in the horse racing. It's not guaranteed, but if you want to help doing a bit of extra cleaning around the place, who knows? Anyway, oh, well, good, that's the dreams. So you were dying. Okay, no luck. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in one of the sutra I read, there was a part where the Buddha told one of his disciples to go to the dead body land and observe and meditate on it. He was imagining different parts of his body decaying. What kind of meditation is that? What does that help us with? How can you meditate if you can give us some guidance? And a dead body land. It was just where they have the charnel grounds. in those days, instead of actually even cremating people, sometimes they just throw the bodies in these places and let them rot and decay by themselves. Or sometimes they would cremate them. And even when I was wandering through Thailand, Ajahn Chah advised me, go to the places where they do the burning of the bodies and you meditate there. And I didn't understand why until he told me. I found out. Because if you wanted some peace and quiet, that was the best place to go. No villager would come close to you. If you did other places, they'll come around in the evening and they just pester you with the questions. I wouldn't mind if it was Buddhist questions, but I would ask, you're a Westerner, how long have you become a monk? What does your mother and father do? You got any brothers and sisters? What did you do before you became a monk? And after about a couple of hours of that, you get fed up. So you say, where's the charna ground? Where are the ghosts? And I go hang out with them. It's much more peaceful. So anyway, but in particular, to understand your attachment to this body. And especially if it's a disciple, if it's one of the monks there, because, you know, monks, young men, they still have lust. Young nuns, any young nuns here? No, you all passed it. That's a compliment. Past, you know, that lay life stuff. But anyway, you know, that's one of the reasons why you don't wear shoes in Buddhist temples. So they can't throw them at you. But anyway, so they have this when we have novice ordinations. They have it the same for novice nuns, novice monks. That we have these five meditations. Hair of the body, hair of the head, nails, teeth and skin. The five little meditations. And the reason we do that is because if you see anybody, all you see is hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. That's all you see when I look at people. And so we're told to do that if you see this incredible, beautiful girl come in the temple. And then what do you see? Just hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin, that's all you see. And when you contemplate it, hair of the head, it's all dead. The dead stuff, because the live stuff, the roots are underneath the skin. You can't see the roots, which is alive. This is all dead stuff. Same with hair of the head and hair of the body, all dead stuff. Nails, it's all dead, because the live ones are underneath. Same with the teeth, you just see this is dead. The roots underneath. And also skin. The skin, the epidermis on the outside, that's dead, and sort of underneath, that's the live part. So that's what we contemplate. You see this beautiful supermodel come in to the monastery. You see, it's just dead stuff. That's all I'm seeing. Who want to kiss that? Yuck. Ugh. Hug that. Touch that. It's just touching dead stuff. Ugh. So in other words, what we do, if you have attachment and lust, we look at the other side of it. If you have distaste, then we look at the positive side of it. So this is actually just how we look at these things. So we look, you know, if you're heterosexual, the other gender, if you'd ever notice, you look at that part, you know, which attracts you. And the part which attracts you, you build up, you fantasize, you just dwell on that, and all the negative you just don't even see. Just like this disciple in Singapore, she told me, apparently a true story, when she got married, her father took her new husband aside, gave him some father-in-law advice, and said to the son-in-law, you probably love my daughter very, very much. He said, oh yeah, she's amazing, she's wonderful, she's perfect in every way. Yeah. So, that's what it's like when you first get married. You're in love. You can only see the beauty, the charming parts of your partner. But, said the father-in-law, he said, I know my daughter very well. In a couple of years' time, maybe three, maybe earlier, but roughly about 2 or 3 years' time, you'll start to see the faults and defects in my daughter. And please remember this, son-in-law. If she never had those faults and defects to begin with, she'd have married someone much better than you. Well, you're saying that we all have faults and defects. But the trouble is that when we have this craving, this wanting, all we have, we don't see the defects, we just see the beautiful side of things. When we have ill will, we never see the beautiful side of things, we only see the defects. So this is actually to balance. So whoever was the Buddha told to go to the place where the dead bodies were, which has been obviously had a bit too much lust and too much craving. So just to see the opposite side. You see that side, you see the good side, and then after a while you find it's just a body, that's all. There's also, every now and again, you do get like supermodels come on the retreat. Honest, because I was giving a retreat in North Perth some years ago, and it's amazing just how many Thai young men came on my retreat. You never even see them in the temple. But they came on a retreat, and I said, what's going on? And because there was a really famous Thai supermodel, and a film star was actually on the retreat. And there's also other, you know, film stars, or supermodels, Kate Moss. She's a very devout meditator. And I mean, one of my friends, they actually went on a retreat with Kate Moss. And yeah, she's a supermodel, she's really famous, even I know her name. And anyway, that he said, you know, during the retreat, he opened his eyes, he was looking for her, which one is Kate Moss? And it's interesting, he said he couldn't tell which one was Kate Moss. Because she only looks beautiful, you know, when you get the right lighting, the makeup, the hairdo, the clothes, and the airbrushing. You know, once you've got the photo taken. And they said that was the skill of the talent of a supermodel. It was like a blank plate where the makeup artists and the other people, they could actually make whatever you wanted out of it. But in real life, they never looked like that, which was fascinating. But there's also on the other side, one of people here, and you know who she is. I don't mind telling the names, you know, Judy. She went over to see His Holiness the Dalai Lama over in India. And you can go and see His Holiness, but it takes a while. You have to put your name on a list, stay there long enough, and your name comes up. You come to the front of the queue, have an interview. So she was in Dharamsala, for a long time. And then she would meditate in the mornings. Everyone would meditate. She was meditating there quietly in the morning, and somebody came and sat next to her in a meditation hall. And she just casually glanced, and there was Richard Gere. And then that was the end of her meditation. Breathing in, Richard Gere. So anyway, just that sort of stuff. Anyway, that's just places of dead bodies. Ajahn, do you need a lot of merit to get the determination to ordain? Ah, sometimes. Sometimes not, sometimes a bit of good luck. Is it true that you need parami to receive jhana? Well, I think you need a lot of merit. You need a lot of parami means like spiritual accumulated goodness. You don't know how much you've got and how much you haven't got. So sometimes people will say, oh, I haven't got enough good karma this lifetime to come on a retreat or become a monk or a nun. How do you know? So give it the benefit of the doubt. And in the time of the Buddha, had these people getting enlightened, and there were some of them really poor. Some of them were, you know, a little bit sort of mentally challenged. Like one of my favorite monks, this is not even the time of the Buddha, this was when I was a young monk. I told this story in a retreat, never finished it. This was actually at the Nolamara temple. This was a monk, I was out before he was a monk, a kid, grade one at school in Thailand. After 1 year in grade one, he failed. The teacher could not pass him to go to grade two. I don't know what he failed. No, stick drawing, plasticine, or I don't know what you do in grade one. you know, singing sort of Old MacDonald out of Farm or whatever. Couldn't remember. Well, anyway, he failed. So he had to sort of, you know, repeat grade one. All his friends went up to grade two. So he had to, you know, stay behind. It's 2 years in grade one, failed again. And 3 years. And with the best will in the world, the teacher just could not pass him. Now that is really mentally challenged, or intellectually challenged, or whatever. So this was, you know, I've heard of people, you know, failing grade 8 and 9 or something, or 10, or, but failing grade 1, I mean, that is Guinness Book of Records stuff. So what do you do in, you know, the rural Thailand when somebody fails grade 1 three times? They're too stupid to know how to plough fields or look after the water buffalo, so there's only one place for them, the temple. So they ordained him as a novice, little novice monk. And the head monk, you know, was just so patient for a couple of years, tried to teach him just simple chanting, Namo Tassa Bhagava. This is the simple stuff. And he could get Namo, but then what was the second word? When he learned Tassa, what was that first word again? And, you know, with that incredible patience, the head monk of the temple just, oh, he said, it's a waste of time. So there was only one place to go now. The last resort for this young boy. The forest monastery. Where you don't have to do too much chanting. So he sent him to the forest monastery. And his mind was just so simple. So peaceful. They taught him meditation. And he just got into deep meditations, jhanas. He became an arahat, fully enlightened. And to this day I cannot remember his name, because it was when I first became a monk the story was going around. And he had to do some chanting. We always have to do some chanting, giving five precepts or something. But the only way he could do that was that, you know, because he had very, very obviously great meditation, he could actually remember a previous life when he was a monk, when he could know the chanting. He connected with that, and that's how he used to chant. In this life, he just couldn't do it. So that's wonderful. Just there was a person, you know, just lots of merit, not in the realm of actually just intellectual. And there was, you know, these other people, this Angulimala, the serial killer, became enlightened. There was Patachara, the great bhikkhuni. She was just went out of her mind, because on the same day she lost her father, her mother, her husband, and her two children on the same day. There was what's her name, Kisa Gotami, who lost her kid, was really crazy. She, another great bhikkhuni, enlightened being. And some of these people were just, you know, mad, crazy, had sort of psychotic episodes, were deformed, or were just, you know, not all that intelligent, and they all managed to become enlightened. And I like that, because it means just anyone can. Isn't that the doors are open? So it's great that do you need paramita to receive jhana? Do you need merit to get to ordain? You've probably got enough. You've been born as a human being. You've come to Jhana Grove, which is, you know, a great place to meditate. You've got a lot of merit already. So what more do you need? So some people use that as an excuse. I haven't got enough merit, so I'm going home. You have got enough. Take the benefit of the doubt. In Patipata, the biography of Ajahn Mun, it is stated that he reprimanded monks who did walking meditation in the east-west direction. The writer of the biography says he cannot recall the reason for this. Do you know the reason for why walking meditation be avoided in this direction? There is no reason. Go, my young. Because, according to tradition, the Buddha should always be facing east. And so when my predecessor, Ajahn Jacaro, when we built, you know, he was his design, I had a different design. When he built the hall at Bodhinyana Monastery, the Buddha statue, you go over there, it's facing west. So, when one of Ajahn Chah's chief disciples came to visit, the Thai people complained. They said, these Westerners, they don't really know what to do. The Buddha statue is facing in the wrong direction. And this chief disciple of Ajahn Chah said, listen, if the Buddha wasn't happy facing in that direction, he'd turn around by himself. Shut up. No, it's fine. There's good energy there. We've done really well over there. So east-west direction, north-south direction. It's more important you walk in some direction instead of just sitting there complaining and whatever. So it's fine, east, west, north, south, whichever direction you want to do. And anyway, I don't know if any of you who know the customs, but on the way into Jhana Grove, there's two lions, you know, just protecting and welcoming you. They come just like the stupas outside there. They came as a gift from one of the monks in Indonesia, Venerable Sri Panyawaro. And I was very friendly with him, and he just knew of building Jhana Grove. And, you know, very kindly just got some funds together to offer these stupas, you know, from the devotees in Indonesia, and also the lions. But when we put them in there, that the Indonesians came and said, hey, you've got them the wrong way around. There's, you know, one is a male, one is a female. Have a look. And then you know where to look. And very lifelike, crazy. But anyway, they should be the other way around. So they complained to me, said, look, you've got them the wrong way round. And I said, look, you should remember this is Australia, down under. We do things the other way around here. No, down under, that's what Australia means. So he said, okay. So anyway, so east, west, north, south, whichever way. The most important thing is that you meditate. How does one discern between a past life recollection during meditation versus an ancient past spirit channeling some messages to me? Haven't had either of these experiences before. No. Would appreciate your insight and clarity. Thanks. Past life recollections is... they're weird stuff, but they're true. Is, first of all, you have to have a pretty deep meditation. Usually at least nimitta stages, but if you've been in jhanas, ooh, yeah. And way to do it is just after you've, you know, had a really deep meditation, then you obviously you're just coming out to be able to make the suggestion, you ask yourself, what is my earliest memory? And see what happens. If your meditation is strong enough, basically the five hindrances are either overcome or they're very, very weak, what's my earliest memory? And the mind will pick up something from a long time ago. Almost immediately. You don't have to wait for it. You can't force these things. Either you're ready and it happens or it doesn't. And if it happens, what's my earliest memory? It's like being back there. It's not like sort of remembering just what you had for lunch today. I'm sorry, I shouldn't mention food this time of the evening. Oh, I'm hungry now. But it is actually just something which is like you're back there again. And you're re-experiencing it. Just like one of these ladies, what shouldn't we say who she is? She was interested, she had some good meditation. And so she remembered earliest memory. First one is usually early on in this life as a baby or something. She remembered being breastfed, a little baby, just maybe only a week or two born. And she looked up and she was shocked because the woman breastfeeding her wasn't her, who she thought her mother was. And it was very clear, you know, it's not just, you know, you're just imagining this. It's like seeing a person right here. Very clear, very vivid. That's not my mum. So she came to the interviews as soon as possible and told me, said, you know, this is what I've had. I think I may have been adopted. That this is not my real mum. And you know, when you actually feel like that, that's really challenging for you. So I said, well, the only thing you can do is just, now after the retreat is finished, go home, see your mum, and ask her, you know, in a nice way. And so she did that. She told what happened. She went up to her mother and just had a little chat about this, that and the other. And said, oh, by the way, Mum, is there anything you haven't told me about my birth? Are you really my mum or was I adopted? And her mother looked at her, what the heck are you saying? Of course I was your mother. I was there. I gave birth to you. Why are you saying that? And when she described the person who she saw, you know, in the deep meditation, her mum was just so impressed and astounded. That was your witness. Very clear description. Even I can understand from your description. Because, you know, that she was came from a very high-class family. And so they had a witness to breastfeed her in the first years of her first weeks and months of her life. I said, how on earth could you remember that? That's incredible. So that's what happens. It's a really good memories, very clear. And they're not what you expect sometimes. So that actually makes it very, very convincing to you. You know, so you know, that was just not past life, that was early life. But then you say, earlier, please. And just even go back earlier. Warning to you, because you know, some people do this. You know, not everyone can. You've got to get nice deep meditation, first of all. But when somebody does get those, they go back earlier, maybe in the mum's womb, earlier please, and you go to the closest memory to this life, which is your death moment. And so a lot of people, I can understand why, that you know, we experience your last death, and for some people, actually for most people, it's a very unpleasant experience. Now up to the death, after death is fine. But just for that period. And so a few people have told me, said, Ajahn Brahm, please let people know that it's, you know, that's a real big problem, because, you know, re-experiencing the time you died before is not that nice. But I said, look, I should have told everybody. The answer to that problem is, if you do, you know, get these experiences, you're re-experiencing them, then just ask yourself earlier, please. So just to, you know, to go back, to press the rewind button, to go a little bit earlier back, you know, into your a more pleasant experience in your previous life. And the nice part of this is, if you can do that, then when you get back early, you know, get some details. You know, you can move around, you can look around, just, you know, and just all you need to do is just to, you know, to think, you know, what's my name? And you know your name. Like, right now, what's your name? Of course, you know your name. Where is this? Jhana Grove. Sort of what year? No, 2018. But you know, this is, you remember past life. It's just, you know, 1912 or something. So you can remember these things. And it's interesting to ask those details simply because then you can check them up. And then, because there's libraries and people keep records these days. And you check it up, you get the records, and when you see the name comes up so many times, oh, that's freaky. You know, just, it's real. That really was me. And so, you know, it actually proves to you, once and for all, there's such a thing as rebirth. Past lives. Explains so much. I don't see why people don't actually accept that. Receiving dana every day for lunch is like having a Christmas banquet during this retreat. Could you refresh us on the concept of food meditation? I'm willing going to put on 5 kilograms by the end of this experience. You know, sometimes it's not you put on weight because of what you eat. It's because you don't worry. You have a very beautiful, peaceful life here. So because you don't worry, you don't waste so much energy. Just how much energy is wasted when people get angry and upset and think and worry? And that's when you really lose a lot of weight. But 5 kilograms by the end of this experience, a Christmas banquet during this retreat. It is wonderful that people are being kind to you. And sometimes it's, you know, where this food comes from. You've noticed here, one of the reasons this is, you know, very inexpensive, you know, that the monks, you know, built a lot of these things. I always like to say the floor you're sitting on that side over there, the builder promised me again and again and again will finish in time, in plenty of time for the opening ceremony. And when I questioned her, she said, are you doubting my professional ability? She scolded me, but I was right, she was wrong. Because the day before the grand opening, the people doing the floor quit, and only about half the floor was on here. And we're having a big ceremony the next day. And the person who was opening it was Jeff Gallup, because, you know, I'd helped him out with his depression. And so, you know, it's a bit of a payback. He decided that he would actually be he still is the patron of China Grove, and he was the Premier of Western Australia. You know, it was so close. I was so close to changing the world, because, you know, I got to really know Jeff Gallup, you know, Jeff Gallup, he was the best man at Tony Blair's wedding. So, you know, his best friend was Tony Blair, so I had a conduit to the Prime Minister of England, and from the Prime Minister of England to George W. Bush. I was so close to converting George W. Bush to being a Buddhist, and then Jeff resigned. Anyway, just messing about. But it was very close to Jeff Gallup. But anyway, about 7 o'clock in the afternoon, the monks came to the rescue, and they just finished off the bamboo floor. Finished off about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, in time for the opening ceremony about 8 o'clock the next day. That's amazing, isn't it? It always happens that way. That's the best way. The very last minute, and just kindness, goodness, service comes in. So that's why it's a nice, inexpensive. And Bianca, she's just come in. She never charges. This is her dana. See how hard she works? For free. Doesn't get a salary. And she's a relief teacher. But isn't it wonderful? And all the people who come here bring the food. They don't have to. They come on retreats, and when they're not on retreats, they come and bring food from town. And it's really beautiful food, good food. So, isn't it wonderful? And so sometimes you eat that food, and just where it comes from, that makes it delicious. So, I think it's really worthwhile. Maybe you don't need to eat it, but they need to feed you. If mind is a forerunner and motivation is the driving force in making calm, why do I feel happiest when I directly offer something to a good monk or nun? Exactly, it's just, you know, doing good. And sometimes the purity of the receiver, the goodness of them, and they give you a nice big smile, because this is what we train in, smiling. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. We train to smile, be happy. And so, even though motivation or intention is supposed to be all important, I never feel as much joy when I put the tins of mushy peas in the pantry as I do when I get to put it directly into a monk's bowl, or even give the tins into the hands of a monk or nun. My goodness, you'll be feeding me with a spoon for a while. It is true, you do get a lot of happiness in giving stuff to people. And it's just, any possible opportunities you have to give, don't miss it. Doesn't matter what it is. Some of the greatest acts of generosity which I've seen. One of them was in monastery in Thailand. I was cleaning up the hall, and I was actually just out of sight, just behind a big cupboard, and I heard somebody creep in, and I was a bit concerned because it wasn't like a normal person creeping in. I thought it was a thief, a burglar. So I just peered, and I recognized who it was. There was a girl in the village who was some mental impairment, because she could not speak. She could grunt. And I was so amazed, because even though, it was in a place like Australia, probably institutionalized or trained or something, this girl was part of the village. She would do everything with everybody else. She grew up with people of the same age. And her friends could understand what every grunt meant. And it was amazing to see this. Now, to me, it was just noise, but They'd grown up with her and understood exactly what she meant. It was, you know, their secret language. It was wonderful to see that, you know, she was part of things. And it was her creeping in, and I wondered, what the heck was she doing? And I saw her looking around, she didn't see me, and she put something on the shrine in front of the Buddha. She put it and just, she bowed three times and she ran out. And what she put on the shrine? And I looked in there and it was this folded paper lotus. You could do something much more, and much more well folded, more like a lotus. It was a, you know, like a work of art, but when I knew where it came from, that was just such a beautiful lotus, folded by this impaired girl. And when I saw that, I just almost shed tears. Well, what I did do, because I was cleaning up in the evening, I told the monks, you know, what that lotus was doing on there. And if anything, any monk, didn't care who it was, thought that that was not beautiful enough to put on the shrine, they would have me to deal with. I would go cranky on them, because that, we're going to stay on that shrine for as long as I possibly could. It was a great, beautiful gift, because it was so hard to do. That's what I really like. It's just when people just give stuff. One of my great donations, when I was a layperson, I had money. I heard this, you know, this is 60s or something, or 70s. I was a student. I was really, you know, legitimately poor. I know everyone says they're poor, but, you know, I really was poor. And I had holes in my jeans way before they became fashionable. And this Tibetan, it was Western English, ordained in Vajrayana tradition. She was running a orphanage up in Kalimpong. And she was telling about all the good work she was doing. And I was really inspired. It wasn't like talking about the next meeting of the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. I could read that in a book. This was someone who's living a very compassionate life. And I was so inspired. The next day I went to my bank and got £20 out to give her as a donation. And that was 2 weeks' food money for me. Actually, more than that. I went hungry. They were starved, but I did without. You know, it hurt me. But I never, ever regret that. That was some of the best dana I've ever given. So I always remember that. Just, it hurts. I was hungry. But as a young man, you know, you can eat as much as you want. But I couldn't eat that week, not much. Just small stuff, just to get by. But I never regret that at all. That's what dana is. And it's not just giving money, it's just giving some kindness. Sometimes. Okay. This is a monk from the Franciscan tradition in the time of St. Francis. And I love this story. I think I told it just when I was in Penang. He was on, because in that tradition they used to go on alms round as well, the Franciscan monks. And he went on alms round. And of course, you know, there was a beggar who saw him and said, "What are you begging from us for? You know, that you're more rich than we are. Look at your clothes and look at me, I'm in rags." And the monk said, "Actually, you've got a point there. You know, look at it must be very cold in your rags." So the monk took his robe off and gave it to the beggar. And it's amazing, the generosity like that. And so when the monk came back into the Franciscan monk came back in the temple, he was, you know, naked. He'd given his robes away to the beggar. And so they thought he was a sexual pervert. "Get out of here, you know, this is for monks, you're not allowed in here. Get away." And when they started speaking, they said, "Oh, it's you. What happened? Come inside. Were you attacked? Were you robbed?" He said, "No, no. I saw this really poor beggar who was much more needy than I was, and so I gave him my robe." He said, "Wow, you know, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's a real good monk." And so they got another robe out from the stores and gave it to him. The next day he was on alms round. Of course, the word gets around. This monk is a bit, you know, soft in the head as well as soft in the heart. So another guy, you know, just borrowed some rags from somewhere and said, "Oh, look at me, I'm only wearing rags." And so he gave his robe away again. So he came back naked the next day. This time they recognized him. "Okay, come inside." And I think after about four or five times coming back naked, because they're always exploiting him to the max, these, you know, the people, some of them weren't even beggars. And so that after five or six times coming back naked, the you know, they gave him a robe, and then the abbot called him into the office. And he scolded him. And he said, look, you know, it's nice to be generous. We've only got so many robes, you know, in the storeroom. And these were offered by people, not to give to the beggars, you know, but, you know, they're taking advantage of you. You know, the word has got around that you just want to wear a few rags for an hour and just meet this man, you get a new robe. They're really expensive robes. You know, you shouldn't do this. And he was scolding him and scolding him. And this monk would just, you know, put his head down. He wouldn't defend himself at all. He wouldn't sort of try and justify his actions. He just sat there, stood there, head down, listening to the scolding from the abbot. It went on for over an hour. And when the abbot thought he'd, you know, taught him a lesson, so he can go now. And half an hour later, the monk was knocking on the abbot's door again. And the abbot opened it, and he said, he gave him a cup of hot soup to the abbot. He said, what's this for? He said, well, you've been shouting at me for over an hour. You must have a very sore throat. This is for you. And this monk was sincere. You know, he wasn't trying to sort of, you know, be sort of cheeky or sarcastic. He really, when he was being scolded by the abbot, all he thought about was how the abbot's throat must be hurting. And so the first thing he did was get some soup and give it to the abbot. At which the abbot said, there's nothing I can do with you. Give as many robes away as you want. And I love that little story, like kindness and generosity. It's really beautiful. And especially when being scolded by someone. For some, you don't really deserve a scolding. You just sit there and just take it. And then afterwards, you give a cup of soup. So if you get a scolding from your boss when you go back, just listen there. And after the boss is finished, go and get some soup. Boss, he must have a sore throat. Well, it's kind of like that. Anyway, where we go. Is mindfulness of anicca anatta dukkha too much thinking? Oh, yeah. Out of place in a meditation on the breath. We did this yesterday, I think. Okay. It is too much thinking. The best time to actually really understand these things is actually when you've got some more experience of anicca, things vanishing. I don't know what that's doing there, because that was there yesterday. So even people think anicca, they know what anicca is, but you know, if anicca to get you enlightened, it's not just seeing rise and fall. The whole idea of rise and fall, that is not what it means, even in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Samudaya Atagamana. If you look, or Vaya Dhamma, if you look in the Satipatthana Samyutta, where the Buddha goes into more detail about, you know, what the Satipatthana means. He said, what this means is what causes these things to arise. And when these things, the causes, vanish, then the thing vanishes. So you know what causes, like, the body to arise. And so it's just, it is, what are the aharas, the causes? It's obviously food. Experience, like pasta, contact. It is will and consciousness. There's another one there somewhere. But anyway, the will and consciousness really, the sensory experience. Because if there's no sensory experience, if you can't see, hear, smell, taste and touch for long periods of time, your body just stops. So that's one of the reasons why that anyone in a coma, if you don't give them some sensory experience, you know, such as, you know, touching them, stroking them, talking to them, then they pass away. And stimulation of the five senses is important to keep the body going. And obviously willpower, you know, you have to want to live. So if you give up, you know, the desire to live, and of course, you know, you fade away. Sometimes, it's so often I've seen this. Your grandma is really sick in hospital, say in Singapore, and you know that she's hanging on there, and then you manage to get there, see your mum or grandma or whatever, and say goodbye, and a half an hour later she goes. She waits for you, keeps going, because she needs to do that before she allows herself to go. So these are the things which keep the body going. And for experience, you know, you just need the contact and the attention. For the mind, you need objects of mind, nama-rupa. When they disappear, the jitta stops. And the mind objects is attention. So this is actually when we understand what anicca really is. Things vanishing. When they vanish, we know there can't be a permanent essence. So the best time to do this, again, is just right at the very end. When the meditation is really peaceful and powerful. Hi, your emptiness. When we start thinking in meditation, should we bring our awareness back to whatever is our focus or just watch it and do nothing? Don't do nothing. Nothing doing. Because people try and do nothing. That's more doing. I was telling people that in the interviews that so often I was taught if your mind wanders off, bring it back to the breath. If it wanders off, bring it back to the breath. If it wanders off, bring it back again. Bring it back, bring it back, bring it back. And you spend all your life doing that until you realize, why does it wander off? Because you weren't being kind to your breath. So when we start thinking in meditation, you're trying to escape from something. What are you doing that for? Because you're not content where you are. You don't build contentment and happiness here, right now. You don't need to think. Who wants to give it? A name. As I said last night, when you say, what a beautiful sunset, you're not watching the sunset anymore. You're watching the words. After a while, you get used to the silence, so you don't think. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I felt puzzled when reading the basic method of meditation. The book describes 7 stages leading to the first jhana and specifies that each stage must be completed before going to the next. Well, there's always the shortcuts. Otherwise, the high stages will be unreachable. Maybe not unreachable, but a bit sort of unstable or a bit dodgy. Isn't this a bit technical and complicated and odd with your simile of the 3 mailboxes all leading to the same big box? Also, how does this translate time-wise? Hours, days, weeks, or months for each of the 7 stages? And how do we know whether we have mastered a specific stage and can safely move on to the next? Exactly. You don't think too much. So, that is a nice little plan of meditation. It's nice to say stages because people want to know where they are. It just it makes people feel happy. You've got this stage and that stage and the next stage. But, you know, in real life, sometimes there's not those stages. Sometimes even in schools, you know, you skip a year, you know, because you're a high flyer. Or, you know, sometimes universities, you know, you choose this subject and that subject and go back to it later on. So, no, life is never that sequential. And anyway, that these stages are all going in. Sometimes you can go in quite fast and just miss something, but, you know, you just go through it so quickly. It must be completed before going to the next. That means just trying to get people to be more patient. So you don't rush these things and say, right, there's, how many more days to go? 4, 5 days? 7 days? 6 days? Well, okay, you've already got to stage 1, so you've got tomorrow, do stage 2. Next day, stage 3, 4. Sometimes people, that's like the world, stuff like that. So those stages of the Anapanasati just are helpful. But it just gives a rough, they call it a mud map of what it is. And time-wise, sometimes people go really quick, sometimes slow. Doesn't matter, don't think of hours, days and weeks. So just don't be a prisoner of time. Actually, when I meditate, I go into a relaxed state which does not have any awareness. It feels a bit like the state you are in just before falling asleep. However, I don't fall asleep, but how do I have any awareness? What can I do to deepen my meditation? You have some awareness, otherwise you'll be unconscious. So you have some awareness, but it's not the normal awareness, and it's very weak. So what to do? If you get into a relaxed state, just allow the awareness, the mindfulness, just to investigate. What is this? I say it sometimes, it's like you're in a lit room and going into a darkness. At first you can't see what's out there because it's dark. It takes a while for the pupils of your eyes to expand, to allow more light in so you can see where you are. So sometimes if you're in a relaxed state, just leave it there. Don't fight it. After a while the mindfulness will get stronger, you'll be able to find out what's actually there. So just leave it. If you have a very active mind during meditation, can you use some sort of mantra to achieve some sort of stillness? Yeah, there's many, many mantras. We talked about or mentioned Buddha the other day. But a much better mantra is as you breathe in, if you've got a very active mind during meditation, you breathe in, you recite to yourself, shut. As you breathe out, up. Shut up. Shut up. Shut up. It gives yourself a bit of fun. So the reason we have fun is that actually, you know, people pay attention when it's fun. Have you ever been to a talk and it's just so technical that you see people just sitting down there and just falling asleep? What's the point of that? So I put energy into my talks, a bit of fun and games every now and again. So in between the jokes is actually some dhamma. Keeps you alert. So some sort of mantra achieves some sort of stillness. If you have a very active mind, okay, this is some dhamma serious stuff. The similes to understand, why do you have an active mind? Why can't you stand back at it and just see it's just, you know, clouds going through the sky, it's just stupid thoughts. They're not getting anywhere. It is because we get emotionally entangled in our thinking. We give it importance and power. And to understand what I mean, the similes, when I was a student, used to sometimes, you know, just go out with your friends and our girlfriends, you know, just go watch a movie together, you know, four or five, like, couples, sort of. They're not obviously engaged, but just your girlfriends and go together. So we went, about three or four of us, with our girlfriends to see West Side Story. It's an old movie, okay, but this was in the 60s, 70s. West Side Story. It was Romeo and Juliet set in the West Side of New York. It was Tony, who was Italian. Tony, who was Puerto Rican, with Maria, who was Italian. In those days, you know, that was a no-no, forbidden, two different sort of, family groups. Now, they weren't really supposed to have any relationships together. But anyway, they fell in love. And one thing led to another, and that it was Maria's brother was out to kill Tony. And Maria was looking for the love of her life to warn him that her brother was out to kill him. And after a long messing around, that they finally, there was Tony was under the lamppost, you know, the street lights, in the rain, in the middle of the night, in a poor part of New York. And Maria saw him and warned him, Tony! And at that point, Maria's brother saw him as well and shot him. Shot him right through the heart. And so Maria ran to her lover and held him in her arms as he was dying. And there, I've been to New York, and I've, you know, sometimes late at night, but I've never seen this. An orchestra started playing. And they started playing the tune as she sang, there's a place for us, somewhere, a place, a time for us. It was a theme song. And I'm not going to try and sing it because I'm too compassionate to inflict such suffering on you. And all the girls were weeping, tears were flowing down their cheeks. And us sensitive guys were laughing our heads off. What are you crying for? It's only a movie. And they knew I was a Buddhist. I said, look, wait for another an hour, you see Tony reincarnated. It's only a movie. But why do you do that? You get emotionally entangled in it, don't you? You know what you're doing, sort of, but you get really entangled into it. Oh, so sad. It's only a movie. Just like the movies which go on in your head. You get emotionally entangled in all those fantasies and past and future plans. They're fantasies too. And, guys, you are just as stupid. I saw this too. Changi Airport, Terminal 3. I know I just go there so often. And in the middle of the, there's a big sports lounge. And this huge TV. They're always playing soccer on it. Usually EPL. And see all these guys there. They're watching sort of Liverpool play Manchester United or something. And they're all up there shouting, that was not a penalty. He dived. That was offside. And they're really getting into it, shouting. Number one, that's being played in England. It's a long way from Singapore, you know. Doesn't matter how loud you shout, they won't hear you. And it's also a replay. But the guys get into it. Why? Because when you're there, you're watching that big screen, you get sucked into it. Psychologically, you're there watching the action as if you're in the stands of Old Trafford, live. When you're watching the movie, you're actually right in the movie. You're in New York. You're a friend of Tony and Maria. You're part of the action. You get sucked into it. And that's why you get emotionally entangled. That's why, you know, you get sort of shouting and screaming and crying and really getting sort of excited. It literally does pull you in. And that's actually how we deal with the thoughts. Push them out. Stand back. Put some space between you and all those crazy thoughts. As if you're looking at it from a distance. Detached. At least a little bit detached. When you see them at a distance, they don't have any emotional power over you. You look at this, this is actually stupid. Now what am I getting interested and involved in this for? And when you actually detach from it, put it a distance between you, it's so easy to let them go. When you get pulled into them, ooh, then you're stuck. Under one of the five precepts is do not lie, but in modern society it's difficult to apply. Sometimes a small white lie. Lies? Why do you give them colours? Clothes does not hurt anyone, but will make the person feel good or getting things done easy. Does it count as sinful? There was this English Buddhist, and he had heart problems. I went to see him, and he had to have an emergency bypass. He was, you know, not a wealthy person, so he was in a ward, three other guys. And they're all, you know, waiting for the bypass operation. And the guy in the next bed was the head of the queue, Fred. It wasn't really the name Fred. But anyway, this guy's a Buddhist name was Don. And so Don became quite friendly with Fred. And so Fred had the bypass operation. And then, first of all, and then that evening his wife came to him and came to Don. And Don said, oh, you know, how was Fred? How did he go, this bypass operation? And his wife said, oh, no trouble at all, just, you know, I saw the family outside, you know, just as in ICU recovering. And that's what she said, because she told me that when she called me. And she said, I have to talk to you about this, because this is the first time since I've been married I've lied to my husband. Because he met the family outside, that was the truth, but the family were in grief. You know, Fred had actually died on the operating table from the bypass complications. He hadn't pulled through. And she said, I lied to my husband because I thought that, you know, if he, no, the man who had the the operation today, which he's going to have tomorrow. He'll be so anxious, he'll probably kill him. And he was touch and go for quite a few days. But he pulled through, Don. And so I said to the wife, I said, okay, that lie was okay. And I asked her, now, how long have you been married? He said, about 40 years. So I said, and I repeat that story, one lie every 40 years. That's it. No more than that. Because a lot of times, you know, the white lies aren't really necessary. There's usually other ways you can deal with that. So, because a white lie, with common usage, gets dirty. If a person loves to drink alcohol and eat meats, but practices other precepts, can he still be a good Buddhist if he practices kindness, generosity, compassion, and other good qualities under the Buddhist teaching? There was this guy who was an alcoholic in Thailand. And, you know, he was really hard, you know, to overcome his alcohol addiction. But this fellow, you know, he made a vow for the rains retreat not to drink any alcohol from the sunrise to sunset. And that's the best he could do. And he did it. You know, he always got up really early. And he was hanging out, but he kept his vow. No, for him, that was a hard thing to do. And so we praised him, because it was really difficult. But he did that. So any improvement, we don't judge people. If you can improve, do things a little bit better, then that's great. Hi, Ajahn Brahm, I'm reading Mindfulness, Wisdom Beyond. You wrote, when wise meditators practicing mindfulness observe an unwholesome state trying to break in, they try to stop the defilement, and if the wholesome state does slip in, they try to evict it. Does this go against that we try to make peace and be kind to these unwholesome states and the unconditional mindfulness? That's actually how you stop them coming in. What's the best way to stop thieves coming into your house? Have lots of good people in your house. Lots of really good, friendly, kind people means there's no way the burglars can come in. And how do you evict them? How do you evict the anger-eating monster? By being kind to it. So yeah, it's true. This is just basic, sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, the four right endeavors. And this is just stating that, yes, sometimes you've got to avoid unwholesome states, and also just if they do slip in, just to see how they can be abandoned. But it's not with more ill will. You just feed them. So I say, just the way to evict them, the way to stop them, is not through more ill will. Quite often, soon after I focus on the breath, after leaving past and future behind, my inner eye shows unknown faces and strange landscapes. These soon distract me from the breath and prevent me, and eventually remind me of some past event. What is this? How to overcome it? Don't try and overcome it. There is one great method of meditation, which I always try and introduce at some time. Very similar to the thousand petal lotus simile. And this was one of the key stories in the Opening the Door of Your Heart book, otherwise known as Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung book. Those were the Emperor's three questions. Now is the most important time. The one in front of you, the most important person, the most important thing to do is to care. I'm sure I'll say more about that later on. But that's such an amazing attitude towards life that you develop that and use that for your meditation, the Emperor's Three Question meditation method. So, what's the most important time? Same time you have. This is where your future is made. You don't get enlightened anywhere else, only just now. What is the most important meditation object? The breath, the nimittas, the satipatthana. What's the most important meditation object? Whatever's in front of your mind right now. Give it importance, give it value. Don't try and get rid of it. It's teaching you something. Sloth and torpor, restlessness. Be with it. It's important. Because if you don't give it importance, you're trying to get rid of it, and that causes hindrances to go strong. And what would you do with it? Be kind to it. Care for it. And if you do that, the Emperor's Three Questions, it's amazing. Any object of meditation you can meditate with. And it's amazing just what happens. The kindness, the caring. That came from that doctor who, you know, he was about to resign because one of his patients died. He felt so guilty. And I said, look, you're always going to have your patients die. You know, doctors can't cure everybody. They only cure them temporarily. And eventually you die. And so that's the definition in Buddhism of life. What is life? What is the meaning of life? Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. I'll say that again. Try and find fault with it. Life, a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Your terminal. Anyway, so you can't always cure people, but you can't always care for them. And caring is so much more important than curing. And you can always be successful. Even if somebody dies, they die knowing they've been cared for. Changes the whole ball game. So, meditation. You can't always control your mind, but you can care for it. And if you care for your mind, this is the most important object, and you care for it, it's amazing what happens. Because you're not trying to get rid of anything, you're not trying to attach to anything, you're just caring for it, you'll find you create the cause of very deep meditation in the future. You get more and more peaceful, more and more still. And it's whatever you start with, could be anything. But it's most important, whatever's right here, right now, most important object in the world, caring for it. Now's the only time you ever have. That's powerful meditation. So incredibly simple. Sometimes it's too simple. So people think it can't be important. Dear Ajahn, one of the five aggregates is mental formations. What is the meaning of mental formations? I understand that where there are about six types of mental formations, do we need to know and understand all of them? This is sankhara, and again, mental formations is not the best translation. The more powerful translation is will, for the fourth kanda. It is the process of will and the result of will, things which have been willed. It is volitional formations. And you can go and ask Ajahn Bhumali, but he was the one, he just got out the references and, okay, I always knew that will was involved, but this is central to the fourth kanda, will. It's great when you have that there. Will is suffering. Will is not me, not mine, not a self. That is challenging. You are not in control. Hee hee hee. Can you tell the story of the monks and the weatherman? Yes, I can tell that story. Next question. I'm answering your question. Maybe do it another day. In our practice with the peaceometer, we ask ourselves, how peaceful are we, are feeling at the moment? While doing this, I got stuck into keep asking if I'm peaceful enough and keep trying to make it more peaceful. Could you please share your wisdom to reduce this hindrance? That you find that is causing less peace. So that's the whole point of it. You find out what makes you peaceful, what doesn't make you peaceful. And asking that question, it doesn't make you peaceful at all. So you feel it. One thing I've said to the monks for many years now is that the way into deep meditation's jhanas is an emotional journey. It's not an intellectual journey. You feel your way in. You don't give yourself instructions all the time. So, if you're peaceful enough, feel it. Are you peaceful? How peaceful are you? What makes you more peaceful? So, that's where you shut up, because making noises between your ears just makes you less peaceful. Can we have more than one Buddhism names? What is it? one Buddhism name. Also, can we take the three refuges and the five precept ceremony conducted by senior monks more than once? Yeah, of course you can. So you can take the three refuges and five precepts, but it's just like, you know, can you get married more than once? Even if you've got the same partner. You reaffirm your vows. But you don't sort of, you know, go to the marriage ceremony, reaffirm your vows every time you go into a church or a temple. Maybe next once every 10 years or something, but not every day. Because sometimes it becomes a ceremony, taking precepts and stuff like that. And so sometimes you try and get rid of the rites and rituals. So, precepts, the five precepts. Now, I've seen people doing this in Thailand. They got one finger down. And I never saw that before, because when I was a young monk, you always, you know, put the fingers like this, the palms like this, when you're taking any precepts, but they put one finger down. I said, what's that? I said, well, they chanted all the five precepts, but they're not keeping one today, only keeping four precepts. And then, of course, you started looking. This was in Thailand. A few people had two fingers down. And you looked, they were chanting, Parnati, Parnati, and they had all five fingers down. It means they were chanting and weren't going to keep any. Just so people could see. And that was Thailand. Now Sri Lanka. 13 precepts on the moon days when they go to the temple, like on Wesak Day. And I've never seen. I know five precepts and 8 precepts and 10 precepts for a novice and 227, all these other precepts, but what, 13 precepts? What are those? You know the 8 precepts, you're not supposed to eat in the afternoon. That's the 8 precepts. And so 13 precepts means you keep the 8 precepts in the morning, and after lunch you do your 5 precepts. And that became 13. And sometimes people say, oh, well, you know, you've got a middle way, you know, don't go to extremes. And they say, just a little bit of alcohol is okay, just a little bit of alcohol. They keep on saying that, just a little bit of alcohol. And I say, oh, well, okay, just a little bit of murder, a little bit of stealing, a little bit of adultery. There's always the last precept they say, a little bit. What about the other precepts, little bits? Anyway, when I'm in a relationship, I'm always attached to my partner. How can I live in a healthy relationship? Is it correct to tell my partner what I need, or is this again controlling and expectations? Oh, of course it's okay to tell your partner what we need. It's not about you. It's not about him or her. It's about us. So anything like that, you know, it's about us. So you tell your partner, I know what we need. You know, we've both got needs in a relationship, so it's all about us. Any problem is our problem. And so that's a really healthy partner, because you count as well. So remember, you have to have a relationship with yourself. Sometimes, you know, there's only you there, so who's the most important person in the world? When you go to bed at night, it's you. Because that's all you got there. So I do this when I go to bed at night. Got in the habit. I say, goodbye me. Oh, good night me. Have a nice sleep. See you in the morning. Good night. When I wake up in the morning, here I am again. Have a wonderful morning. Have a wonderful day, Ajahn Brahm. I say good morning to myself. I say good night to myself. I have a healthy relationship to myself. Why not? Because I've got to live with me. So letting go leads to peace. This means that sometimes letting go is engaging with other people to help and do service, e.g. letting go of my needs. It's not really needs, letting go of your wants. Other time, letting go is putting back and restraining myself from getting involved. Letting go of my need to be the helpful, good one. If we see that sometimes when we are helping others, it comes from a sense of self and identity, should we pull back a bit? Oh, something gets so complicated. Just do it. Don't think about it. So if something needs to be done, you just do it. Something doesn't need to be done, you're tired, you just say no and just have a rest. Life is so simple when you don't worry what other people are thinking about you. People are always a bit worried about, oh, they'll say I'm selfish, or they'll say I'm just too much of a busybody. Anyway, one, does meditation help cure diseases such as cancer, blood pressure, and diabetes? Yeah. Only temporarily. It gets you in the end. It's nice. And I always listen to Dhamma talks, but however, when the talk is finished, I forget what it was said in the talk to practice it. Yeah, people tell me that as well. When I say, what did I talk about tonight? All they remember is the jokes. Nothing else. But it doesn't matter. You think you have, don't remember. But the amazing thing is that, you know, you do get brainwashed. Even if it's not actually just the facts of the talk, just where it comes from. Just the kindness, the fun, the joy, to make sure that Buddhism meditation is fun. That much is just incredible. Just, it's radical in our modern age. People think meditation, you should have to sit here really tough, don't move. You're moving. Cut it out. And people get so afraid, they get so tense, and they don't get relaxed at all. So that's some of the things they remember. And some of the other stuff they remember is just what I've been saying about now is the most important time. You know, whatever's in front of you is most important, and just to care. You can't recall that now, but when it's really needed, it will come up. It's like just putting antiviruses in your computer. When they're not needed, you can't remember them. But when they're needed, they come up big time. When I'm doing my day-to-day activities, I try hard to keep my mind still, but it keeps thinking about other things. Of course it has to. There was Ajahn Chah's teaching. This was this gentleman from Sydney who went to visit Ajahn Chah when he was just quite famous, but you know, soon he was going to stop teaching. And being famous, there's so many people surrounding Ajahn Chah. He was waiting away. He came all the way from Sydney to Thailand just for that purpose, nothing else. And so he couldn't get his question answered. There's too many other people talking about all sorts of stuff. So he gave up after a couple of hours sitting. But his taxi wasn't going to come for another hour or two to take him back to the airport to go to Bangkok and then back to Sydney. So he thought at least he could do some good karma by doing some sweeping. So he picked up a broom and was sweeping. He told me this, that he was sweeping and he felt a hand on his shoulder. He turned around, the hand belonged to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah had seen him and decided to give him a quick teaching. Just staying in his hut with all those people who would never be able to give him a teaching. And all he said to this young man from Sydney was, if you're sweeping, give it everything you've got. And then he went away. And you know, he realized that was a very powerful teaching. He said the best teaching he'd ever heard. Not didn't mean just when he was sweeping, give it everything he's got, is when he was resting, when you go to bed at night, when you sleep. Give sleep everything you've got. Don't think about what's going to happen tomorrow or what happened earlier today. Give sleep everything you've got. When you're eating, give eating everything you've got. Stop trying to get enlightened. You know, you're eating, so put your attention on eating. When you are meditating, forget about sort of eating, what's going to have for dinner. You meditate, give meditation everything you've got. When you're showering, you don't think about the food or sleep. You make sure you're nice and clean. So this is what you're doing, give it everything you've got. Even when you're driving a car, you don't go thinking, oh, touching the wheel. Turning left, policeman coming. You know, you've got to watch the traffic, not just watch your breathing. So, no, sometimes you laugh like that, but sometimes it's amazing. Just, I was at a conference. It was in Vietnam some years ago. And, you know, like conference, you give presentations, you have workshops, and you have, you know, leaders of the workshop, you know, just listens, reports, and comes back to give a report to the plenary meeting. That's everybody comes together. So they had the MC, and now we're going to have the report on those who were discussing bhikkhuni ordination, or discussing use of IT, you know, in Buddhism, or discussing this or whatever it was. And so one of the I think the conveners of not conveners, the heads of one of these different groups was asked to give the presentation of, you know, the report. And so, sitting at a table, she got up very, very mindfully. And as she got up mindfully, she pushed her chair back very carefully, and she walked, lifting her feet up and walking very mindfully till she got to the podium. That took about 10 minutes, at which the MC said, "Your time is up." So she turned around and walked. She didn't present anything. There is a time for slow walking, but there is a time to get to that podium quickly so you can give the presentation. I didn't know the right time to do the right thing. So anyway, that is the, whatever that question was. Anyway, it's 9:30, it's too late for the weatherman story. So that's enough for this evening. We've got a few more about the jhanas, but again, we're coming on to that next time. Once you've opened the lotus through jhana, you learn to open it without jhana. I'll do this one. Once you've learned to open the lotus through jhana, do you then learn to open it without a jhana? Again, you don't open it with jhana. You open it with mindfulness and kindness. You open it up with the emperor's three questions. Now the most important time, the thing in front of you right now, whatever that part of the lotus is the most important, and kindness. That's why the emperor's three questions and the lotus simile go together. And the arahats of the lotus always open or just understand how it functions. When it's time to open the lotus, you open it. But it's not always open. You're not always in jhanas. So that is why that sometimes that people don't know who are the enlightened ones and who aren't. That was the time when there was this young novice called Sumana. And because he was only a tiny little novice, the monks would tease him and would just, you know, pull his ears. And when the Buddha on arms round saw these monks pulling the ears of Sumana, that's where the Buddha sort of gave them a talking to. He said, "That novice Sumana has got huge psychic powers, fully enlightened. You don't know what you're playing with. You know, he's so powerful." And that's when he told him the four small things you have to be careful of. You know, the small snakes, even a baby snake can be very venomous, like a baby prince, because later on when they assume being emperor, when they grow up, they remember what you did to them. And the small fire, a bushfire is a tiny fire, especially this time of the year, can mean a huge conflagration, and then lastly, a baby monk or nun. Just because they're small, who's the smallest one here? you don't know what's inside of them. So that could be the arahat sitting there, quiet, peaceful. So do not tease her. So those are the four things. Because if you are an arahat, you don't show it. You don't show off. That's why a lot of times people don't know which one is, which one isn't. Who knows? A real arahat never tells. Okay, anyway, that's enough for tonight. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And remember what I said about when you go to sleep tonight, give it everything you've got. When you get up in the morning, you have a shower, be really here, enjoy the shower. And I also mentioned that before you leave the retreat, remember when you pass the donation box, give it everything you've got. I tried that so many times, it never worked once. Okay, have a good night's sleep.